On January 24, 2006, former UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter spoke to a packed audience at West Hartford Town Hall. The program was introduced by Cheryl Curtis of the West Hartford Citizens for Peace and Justice.
It's an honor and a privilege to be back in West Hartford to speak with you tonight. I wish it was about a better subject, but once again we find ourselves, at least I find myself, reflecting on the issue of Iraq. I've been told time and time again by people, including colleagues and critics on the right, Scott, you were right. Congratulations, man. Good job. Thanks for speaking up. But you know, that's water under the bridge. Let bygones be bygones. It's time we stop focusing on the past and we start focusing on the present and the future and where we're going. And you know, I agree with half of that statement. We need to focus on the present and we need to focus on the future and where we're going. We must. But you can't solve a problem until you properly define the problem. Because trying to seek a solution void of a definition of what you're trying to solve means you're just wasting your time, you're wasting your effort. You see, we can't talk about where we are in Iraq today unless we reflect on how we got there. You know, we're trying to build something in Iraq. This is what we're told over and over again by the Bush administration and those who are defenders of our ongoing presence in Iraq. We're trying to build something positive, they say. We're trying to build democracy. We're trying to build a better life for the Iraqi people. Well, I know this about construction, that before you try and build something, make sure you have a solid foundation. Because if you don't have a solid foundation, anything you try to construct will inevitably collapse in on itself. In Iraq, ladies and gentlemen, we have as corrupt a foundation as one can possibly imagine. And anything we try to build that doesn't recognize this corrupt foundation and seek to mitigate and repair this corrupt foundation is doomed to fail. This is why I refuse to back away from how we got to war, why we are in Iraq. It's imperative that we never forget, that we always reflect on the one truism that exists here. We went to war on a lie. End of story. We didn't go to war on a mistake. This wasn't an accident. This wasn't, oops, we got it wrong. This is why I refuse to let it go. You see, those who acknowledge, hey, we made a mistake on WMD, are seeking to revise history by somehow putting forward the notion that they made an honest mistake. We've been told over and over again by many, including the director, the former director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, that intelligence is a tough business. And sometimes it's an inexact science. And sometimes you get it wrong. Well, you know, I was an intelligence officer for 12 years. And I understand how hard it is. And sometimes you do get it wrong on the periphery. But we never get it that wrong. We never get it all wrong. And what happened with Iraq is we got it all wrong, or that's what they want you to believe. But this is why you can't just say it's water under the bridge and we're moving forward from here. You have to go back, ladies and gentlemen, and reflect not just on the Bush administration and its policies, but you know, we call this Bush's war. George W. Bush got us into Iraq. George W. Bush is responsible for the illegitimate occupation of Iraq. And yeah, he's the commander-in-chief and he issued the orders. But he inherited a policy from Bill Clinton, a policy that had regime change as its primary objective when it comes to American foreign policy in Iraq, a policy that sustained the notion of containing Saddam Hussein's regime through economic sanctions that were linked to a disarmament obligation the United States of America had no intention of allowing Iraq to fulfill. You see, the policy of Bill Clinton is similar to the policy of George W. Bush. To lie about weapons of mass destruction. To lie about the threat posed by Iraq. To maintain the public perception of a non-compliant Iraq so that we can maintain economic sanctions as a vehicle of containing and destabilizing Saddam Hussein's regime, until which time we find the means to remove him from power. The Clinton administration carried this out. So if you want to call it George W. Bush's war, fine. This is Bill Clinton's war, too. You want to call this a Republican war? Call it a Republican war. But it's a Democrat war, too, because that was a Democrat president, and those were Democratic congressmen and senators who voted in favor of the war and sustained this policy. So rather than calling this a Democratic war or a Republican war or George W. Bush's war or Bill Clinton's war, why don't we be honest, ladies and gentlemen? This is an American war. This is about the United States of America feeling that it has an inherent right to do whatever it wants, whenever it wants, however it wants. And that's the truth. And we haven't been honest about this. We said it was about weapons of mass destruction. Ladies and gentlemen, it wasn't about weapons of mass destruction. Yeah, that's the case articulated by the Bush administration. One only has to refer to the letter sent by then-Ambassador John Negroponte of the United States to the United Nations. He sent a letter on the eve of war in March 2003 to the Security Council that articulated the reasons why the United States felt compelled to initiate a unilateral military action against Iraq, void of a Security Council resolution authorizing such an action. The entire text of the letter focuses on one thing and one thing only: Iraq's weapons of mass destruction and Saddam Hussein's failure to disarm, and that these weapons of mass destruction represented a threat to international peace and security that could not be ignored. So it's all about WMD, weapons of mass destruction: chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons, long-range ballistic missiles. Except it was never about weapons of mass destruction. In college, I took this course on history, on treaties, and it was a fascinating course. I don't want to go through the whole course, it'll bore you to death, but the professor started the course by handing out a treaty. It was on Bosnia-Herzegovina back in pre-World War I times. And he said, read the treaty, read the text of the treaty. And we all read the text of the treaty. He said, what's it say? So we went through and we gave him a literal interpretation of each paragraph on what we thought that paragraph meant. And then he handed out the negotiating record of the five parties involved in putting this treaty together. And what you found is that each party had a different interpretation of what each paragraph meant. But that treaty meant nothing because it meant everything. You had to understand the negotiating record to understand what the true intent was. And the reason why I bring this up is when we talk about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, we have to come down to the mandate put forward by the Security Council of the United Nations that made weapons of mass destruction an issue. And this is Resolution 687, passed by the Security Council in April of 1991. Why is this important? Because the resolution says that Iraq is obligated under international law, Chapter 7 resolution passed by the United Nations Security Council, to declare the totality of its holdings of weapons of mass destruction, not just the weapons themselves, but the components, the manufacturing processes, anything dealing with the training of these weapons, declare them to weapons inspectors who are mandated to go into Iraq and oversee the destruction, removal, or rendering harmless of these weapons and this weapons capability. It also says that economic sanctions that were levied against Iraq in August of 1990, linked to Iraq's occupation of Kuwait — keep in mind there was a war fought in 1991 that liberated Kuwait from Iraqi occupation. The Iraqis were evicted in late February, early March 1991. When the Iraqi army left Kuwait, the legal justification for continuing economic sanctions no longer existed. But in April 1991, the Security Council passes a new resolution that calls for the disarmament of Iraq and says that as a means of putting pressure on the Iraqi government to compel them to cooperate in disarmament, we will maintain these economic sanctions, this time linked to Iraq's status of disarmament. If Iraq disarms, is found to be disarmed by the Security Council, sanctions will be lifted. Seems like a pretty black and white, simple thing, doesn't it? That resolution was passed in April 1991. It was drafted by the United States of America, and the United States of America, as a member of the Security Council, voted in favor of this resolution. In May of 1991, Secretary of State James Baker testified before the U.S. Congress, made the following statement: even if Iraq complies with its obligation to disarm, economic sanctions will be maintained until which time Saddam Hussein is removed from power. So that's U.S. policy, getting rid of Saddam Hussein. How do you square the two? How do you have a relationship between a resolution that calls for Iraq's disarmament and this policy statement by the Secretary of State that says that resolution's irrelevant? Well, you got to understand the negotiating history, ladies and gentlemen, what we meant when we put this resolution forward. You see, let's go back and do a little bit of history here. March 1990, Iraq has just emerged from an 8-year war with Iran, a bloody war, a vicious war. Iran, in 1979, toppled the Shah, a pro-American monarch, and he was replaced by an Islamic fundamentalist government led by the Ayatollah Khomeini. It took over the U.S. embassy, took American citizens hostage, and basically were threatening to export Islamic fundamentalism, the Islamic revolution, abroad. The United States viewed Iraq as a bulwark, a secular bulwark against the expansion of this Islamic fundamentalism coming out of Iran, and we supported Iraq during their 8-year war. The war ended in 1988. One of the things that we supported, though, in helping Iraq stop the Iranians was we turned a blind eye. A lot of people said, well, the United States gave Iraq weapons of mass destruction. We did not. We did not give Iraq weapons of mass destruction. We did provide billions of dollars of agricultural loans that we watched. We turned a blind eye as Iraq diverted them to acquire technology from Europe and abroad that was used by Iraq to produce weapons of mass destruction. We did stand by idly while Iraq used chemical agents, chemical weapons against the Kurds in the north, against the Iranians. We did nothing while Iraq built biological weapons capability. We did nothing while Iraq developed a nuclear weapons capability. You see, because Iraq was our ally. Now, after 1988, a lot of Americans had problems. A lot of Americans in Congress had problems with Iraq. They said, hey, we've created a monster here. We've got Saddam Hussein, a dictator, just as emerged victorious in this war against Iran. He has a massive military, and he's now developing weapons of mass destruction capabilities that he can leverage to dominate the Middle East and, more importantly, threaten the state of Israel. He's out of control. But a lot of people articulated, said, hey, look, the best way to deal with Saddam is to maintain an open relationship with this guy. We carry out a policy of what we call constructive engagement. We'll continue to give him billions of dollars of economic aid, knowing that he's diverted it, hoping he'll do the right thing. Well, we had a problem because he wasn't doing the right thing. Many in Congress wanted to impose sanctions. So in March of 1990, President George Herbert Walker Bush sends a senatorial delegation led by Bob Dole, a Republican from Kansas, to Iraq to talk with Saddam. Bob meets Saddam at his palace in Mosul, and he physically embraces Saddam and delivers the following message. The president says you're a true friend of the American people. And that's the image that is broadcast on American television. That's the line that's quoted in the American press. Saddam Hussein is a true friend of the American people. See, the American people aren't up to speed on the reality of the complexity of the relationship between the United States and Iraq. They don't understand that we have a lot of problems with Saddam, that there's serious issues out there. All they know is the simplistic line, Saddam Hussein is a true friend of the American people. This is March 1990. Fast forward to October 1990, with the President of the United States, George Herbert Walker Bush, trying to explain to the American people why he is sending 600,000 of their youth off to fight a war against a true friend of the American people. You see, our true friend invaded Kuwait in August 1990, occupying Kuwait City, driving out the Kuwaiti government, and positioned themselves so that their moves could be interpreted as threatening Saudi Arabian oil fields. The United States is responding militarily, pouring troops into Saudi Arabia. And by October, we're talking about not just about defending Saudi Arabia, but launching offensive military operations to drive Iraq out of Kuwait. And the president's got to explain this to the American people. Now, he's not going to do something that no politician ever does on the national level. You know, be honest and level with the American people. They always say they're going to, I'm going to level with you. Well, if he was going to level with us, he'd explain the complexity of the relationship. He'd explain that the statement that was made in March 1990 was just politics as usual, though although we called him a true friend, he wasn't really a true friend. Now, the president's not going to do that. He wants people to forget about March 1990. See, if March 1990 was about, you know, selling Saddam Hussein as good, now that we're going to war, we have to sell him as evil. And that's what the president does in October 1990. Saddam Hussein goes from being a true friend of the American people to the personification of evil. Those are the terms used by the president. But he takes another step. He says that Saddam Hussein is the Middle East equivalent of Adolf Hitler, who requires Nuremberg-like retribution for his crimes of invading Kuwait. Now, once an American politician couches a threat in those terms, you've eliminated diplomacy as a means of resolving a situation, because you don't negotiate with evil, you darn sure don't negotiate with a Hitler-like figure. See, the president just boxed himself into a trap with his own rhetoric, because the troops we're sending off to liberate Kuwait now have just been given an unmandated task of getting rid of Saddam Hussein. Because the only way we'll ever be able to resolve this situation to the political satisfaction of an American president who calls Saddam Hussein Hitler-like is to get rid of Saddam Hussein. Now, I have to tell you, in the Gulf War, we tried to get rid of Saddam Hussein. I was on a targeting cell that tried to track his movements. We put bombs on a number of homes. We put bombs on a number of convoys. We didn't get them. I feel sorry for the people we did get. They were probably just innocent people minding their own business, but that's war. We tried to get Saddam, we didn't. The war ends, Kuwait's liberated, Saddam still survives. His military is destroyed, his economy is in tatters. Iraq represents a threat to no one. And yet the president has a problem, you see. American troops are coming home, there's parades in the streets of New York and Washington, D.C. We're declaring victory, but Saddam Hussein, the Middle East equivalent of Adolf Hitler, still lives and resides in Baghdad. There's a problem for the president. It's a political problem, though, not a national security problem. The president's victory is incomplete. It won't be complete till he gets rid of Saddam Hussein. But how to get rid of Saddam Hussein? The military's home now. The war's over. We don't have justification. What do you do? Enter the CIA, March 1991. They issue the following national intelligence estimate on Iraq. Saddam Hussein has 6 months to survive, they say. 6 months. All we have to do is contain Saddam Hussein for 6 months. And he will collapse from within. But how do we contain him? Well, we are containing through economic sanctions. But those sanctions were linked to the liberation of Kuwait, which has been liberated. How to continue the sanctions? We need a new justification. Remember the thing I said about studying the negotiating record? I just gave you the negotiating record. Now you know what the United States of America's intent was when it drafted Resolution 687. It wasn't about weapons of mass destruction. It was about creating a vehicle to continue economic sanctions that will contain Saddam Hussein until which time he is removed from power. That's what it was all about. Disarmament was only useful to the United States insofar as it facilitated this policy. And how does it facilitate the policy? By maintaining the public perception of a non-compliant Iraq. That was America's policy from day one. It was never about getting rid of the weapons. It was always about using the weapons as a propaganda vehicle to justify the continuation of sanctions until Saddam Hussein was removed from power. Now, early on, this is easy to do because Saddam Hussein's not cooperating. He makes it easy to maintain the public perception of noncompliance because he is noncompliant. Iraq was obligated to submit a declaration listing the totality of its holdings of weapons of mass destruction. It lied. It submitted a declaration that underdeclared its chemical weapons by over 50%, underdeclared its ballistic missile capabilities by 50%, failed to acknowledge the existence of either a biological weapons program or a nuclear weapons program. Weapons inspectors go into Iraq in May of 1991 and are immediately confronted with the harsh reality that they've been lied to. Now, UN weapons inspectors, at least the version that existed from 1991 to 1998, were not timid souls, had a tenacious nature. We weren't willing to give up. And we pursued the Iraqis and we pursued their lies. And in June of 1991, the inspectors discovered a convoy of over 100 vehicles on the back of which was equipment related to uranium enrichment, part of an Iraqi nuclear weapons program that they said didn't exist. Well, we caught them red-handed, cheating, lying. Now, the resolution that was passed was a Chapter 7 resolution. Pretty much it was a ceasefire resolution. It said, the war is over until we'll terminate hostilities while you cooperate with the inspectors. But if you are found to be a material breach, all bets are off. The war can start again. We find 100 vehicles with this nuclear equipment on board, and what does the United Nations do? Well, Russia, France, and China I throw those out there because everybody, the right wing in America loves to boo and hiss whenever you mention Russia, France, and China. You call them pro-Saddam. They're, bending over to do an anti-American thing. Well, Russia, France, and China went, we need to withdraw the inspectors, and we need to resume military operations. If we're going to pass a law, we have to enforce a law. The United States goes, oh, no. We don't want to do that. The clock's running, guys. We've got 6 months. This is just month two. All right? All we have to do is contain Saddam. He's going to collapse. We don't want war. We don't want to rock the boat. We're just going to continue these sanctions. Saddam made it easy because he's just proved that he's a cheater. So now we'll have no debate to continue sanctions. No, we don't want war. We'll pass a new resolution. We'll say, shame on you, Saddam. You should tell the truth. The whole truth and nothing but the truth. In fact, we require you to submit a new declaration that lists everything. No more lies. Sounds fair enough. Typical UN gobbledygook. But then they did something that's extraordinary, and I don't think many people caught on to it. They told the inspectors, remember, this is a resolution that says Iraq has to disarm. Iraq has to give up its weapons of mass destruction. It says, Iraq, you have to tell the whole truth. No more lies. And then it shifts the burden of responsibility off the shoulders of Iraq and puts it firmly on the shoulders of the inspectors and says, the UN weapons inspectors have to go into Iraq and search for the hidden weapons. Now, how can it be hidden weapons if you told Iraq to tell the truth? So you just built in doubt. You just made it systemic. You see, we'll never believe anything the Iraqis say. The Iraqis will submit a declaration. The inspectors will go in not just to verify the declaration, but search for the hidden capability. You set yourself up for trying to prove the negative, but you can never prove the negative. This scene was created that you'll have inspections going on forever, which is what the United States wanted. They didn't want Iraq disarmed. They want to maintain the notion of a non-compliant Iraq. Now, to give you an example of how this works, or in this case, it didn't work, my initial responsibility was ballistic missiles. That's what I was charged with heading up the investigation. In November 1991, I wrote a report to the United Nations that said, I think Iraq's lying about the ballistic missile capability. I think Iraq's holding on to around a half a dozen mobile launchers with about 100 missiles. Now, remember I said that intelligence analysts sometimes get it wrong? Well, in March 1992, the Iraqi government confessed they were lying. They were holding on to a half a dozen mobile missile launchers. I was right on that, but they were only holding on to 98 missiles. I was off by two. So sometimes we get it wrong on the periphery, but I told you, we never get it totally wrong. I was close, 98 missiles. So now we go in, and the Iraqis declare the missiles. They had blown them up, buried them in the field. We dig up the bits and pieces. We take serial numbers off the bits and pieces. We go to the Soviet Union. We get the production records. We put the serial numbers with manufacturing records, attach it to a missile, put them to shipment records. And in the end, we're able to confirm that 96 of 98 missiles are indeed verified, accounted for. That's pretty good work. Now, we don't know what happened to the two missiles. We got scraps and bits and pieces of metal over there that might be the two missiles. But because the Iraqis lied to us, we can't give them the benefit of the doubt. So we say we can account for all missiles that the Iraqis had except two. We don't know what the final disposition of those two missiles are. Does that mean Iraq is holding on to the missiles, actively hiding the missiles? We don't know. We're not saying that. We have no evidence that they're doing that. We just don't know what happened to the missiles. So the United States, instead of applauding our work, says Iraq has an unaccounted for ballistic missile capability. Go find it. Right, October or August 1992, we go in with a major inspection that sweeps through Iraq, interviews every senior production official, goes through every factory, and comes back out. We follow that up with one in October that interviews their ballistic missile force, their generals, their battalion commanders. We study how they fought the war in 1991. We account for everything. We come back out, and I issue a report. Now, if our job was disarming Iraq, the report I'm about to issue should be received with a standing ovation by U.S. intelligence personnel who were tasked with disarming Iraq. I mean, people said it was a job that couldn't be done. And in November 1992, I go to Washington, D.C., and I brief a room filled with 60 of the leading analysts on ballistic missile issues in the United States intelligence community. And I tell them that we have accounted for all of Iraq's ballistic missiles. There's none left. We have disarmed Iraq. in the field of ballistic missiles. That's a stunning announcement that was received with ice-cold silence by the U.S. intelligence community. Because it's the last thing they wanted to hear. They didn't want to hear that disarmament was succeeding, because a successful disarmament program threatens the American policy. You see, if we disarm Iraq, you got to lift economic sanctions. If you lift economic sanctions, you break containment. If you break containment, Saddam Hussein survives, and that's not what U.S. policy is about. In December, the U.S. intelligence community responded with a four-page memorandum that rejected our findings. And then the director of Central Intelligence goes before the U.S. Senate and says that there's 200 missiles left in Iraq. The Iraqis are hiding 200 missiles. Now, where he got that number, I don't know. But again, to show you the culpability of the American people, or at least the gullibility of the American people, what number do you think resonated with the American media and the American people? A UN inspection data based upon first-hand assessment in Iraq, hard factual data, said there's no missiles left, or a CIA director's statement made to the Congress that said there's 200 missiles. New York Times headlines, 200 missiles left in Iraq. We go to the CIA and we ask them how they came up with that number. So we can't tell you, it's secret. So okay, but we're the ones tasked with finding these missiles. You gotta throw us something, give us a bonus. So they threw us a little tidbit of information. Some of them are hidden in the back of trucks before. Now, Iraq is a nation the size of the state of California. Can you imagine looking for trucks in California with missiles hidden in the back? And what we tried to do in Iraq, we did photo analysis, we found truck depots, we swooped in, we stopped convoys, went in the back of the trucks, and we found nothing. What's this mean? That there are no missiles in Iraq? Or we just inspected the wrong trucks? See, if you build in the notion of proving the negative, we inspected the wrong trucks. We've got to keep inspecting, 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 and it's never going to end. We told the U.S. that this is unsatisfactory. There's got to be something more. You can't shuttle 200 missiles around like that. They said, well, no, not all of them are being shuttled. Most of them are buried underground. Now we're getting somewhere. Buried underground. Where? All right. And they showed us. They showed us defector reports that showed missiles were buried in the deserts in western Iraq. They were buried in tunnels, buried in mountains, buried in, under rivers, under lakes. They said, this is where they're at. They pointed to physical locations. They said, yeah. Great. I called their bluff. I said, let's build a ground-penetrating radar that we're going to mount on the helicopter. And we'll also get radar we can put on a boat. And we're going to go inspect each one of these things. And we spent $12 million of U.S. taxpayers' money to build these things. We tested them out in California and took them to Iraq. And for 2 months, we scoured the deserts of western Iraq, looking at every site. We took dive teams into the rivers, investigating every river bottom. We put dive teams in the lakes, investigating lake bottoms, and we found nothing. Every site came up a dry hole. So in November 1993, I go back to CIA headquarters, and we brief the senior leadership, including the director of Central Intelligence, Jim Woolsey, and say, hey, look, your 200 missiles don't pan out. There's nothing there. We stand by our original assessment. I was thanked. My hand shook and invited to leave while they kept my boss there. Rolf Akeas, a Swedish diplomat. Woolsey turns to my boss and says, we did good analysis. We agree, there's not 200 missiles. The number's 12 to 20, and that number will never change, regardless of what you do. That was the one honest thing the CIA said. If you take a look at the CIA's assessment of Iraqi ballistic missile capability, March 2003, on the eve of the war, 12 to 20 Scud missiles were assessed as being left in the Iraqi inventory. The number was based on nothing. It's a fabricated number. It's a made-up number that dates back to 1993. But the CIA was right. That number never changed. Because the facts didn't matter, ladies and gentlemen. The CIA knew in October 1992 that Iraq had been disarmed in the field of ballistic missiles. It wasn't an accident, a mistake, that had the CIA saying that there were 12 to 20 missiles in Iraq in March 2003. It wasn't bad analysis. It was a lie. A lie. They had the same information about chemical weapons. By 1994, the CIA knew that there was no more chemical weapons capability in Iraq. By 1996, they knew the same information about Iraq's biological weapons capability. By 1993, they knew there was no nuclear weapons capability. The CIA knew that Iraq had been disarmed. But the CIA's job wasn't to disarm Iraq. The CIA's job was to get rid of Saddam Hussein. A successful disarmament program was a threat to the American policy. So the CIA's job also became a process of undermining the credibility of UN weapons inspections. Ladies and gentlemen, when the president says he knows that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, remember, that's what he said. The president said, I think there's weapons, or there might be weapons, or there's a possibility there's weapons. The president stood before the American people and said, I know there's weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I know Iraq has massive stockpiles of chemical weapons. I know Iraq has massive stockpiles of biological weapons. The Vice President of the United States said he knows that Iraq is reconstituting its nuclear weapons capability. They knew no such thing. They were making it up. They were sustaining the lie that had been told by Bill Clinton since 1993, 1994. Why is this important? Because it shows that this is not about the national security of the United States of America. Why are we in Iraq? Why are our boys and girls dying? Why are we killing Iraqis? You see, I'm not a pacifist. I'm a warrior. I've gone to war for my country before, and I will go to war for my country again if required to do so in defense of the legitimate national security interests of my country. If there's a threat out there, then we will deal with the threat. But when it comes to Iraq, there wasn't a threat, and our politicians knew this, and our intelligence service knew this. This was about getting rid of a political problem. And he says Saddam Hussein's survival in 1991 posed a political problem for George Herbert Walker Bush. He needed to get rid of Saddam to sustain his grand military victory. He was unable to do so. Saddam lasted more than 6 months. Now the president has no idea what to do. The magic plan of self-immolation didn't work. Saddam is surviving. How to deal with him? Well, let's just wait till after the 1992 presidential elections. We'll put a policy of just containment in place. In October 1992, he tells the CIA, be prepared after the election to get rid of Saddam Hussein. The president signs what's called a lethal finding. It's a covert finding. It's policy made in secret that directs the CIA to use whatever means necessary, up to and including lethal force, to get rid of Saddam Hussein. October 1992. This is the CIA's directive, not to disarm Iraq, not to mitigate a genuine threat against the national security of the United States of America, but to get rid of a dictator whose continued survival poses a political problem to the President of the United States. Well, Bush didn't win the election in November 1992. Bill Clinton did. And now it gets really interesting. You see, Bill Clinton didn't believe in the policy of George W. Herbert Walker Bush when it comes to Iraq. I met with the Iraqi oil minister in January of 1993, and he was almost ecstatic. It's all going to be over soon, Mr. Ritter. We don't have to deal with your kind anymore because we got a new president coming in and we've already talked with his people and they're going to find the conditions under which we can lift economic sanctions. Hallelujah, praise the Lord, and it's all going to be wonderful. Well, the Bush administration had different plans. So they knew what the Clinton administration was up to. And they went ahead and created the conditions in which there was active military combat between Iraq and the United States. The same day that Bill Clinton was being sworn in as the new president, American military aircraft were bombing Iraqi air defense sites and being fired on by Iraqi air defense sites. Now, if you're an incoming president, how can you begin to talk to the American people about a bold new policy initiative with Iraq when we're at war? But Clinton continues to persevere until the spring of 1993, when a new allegation surfaces. This one pertaining to an alleged assassination attempt against George Herbert Walker Bush during his visit in Kuwait. Bill Clinton has no choice this time but to respond. Now, when you take the response he did, which is to fire 42 cruise missiles into a Iraqi intelligence service headquarters building, when you respond in this manner, you legitimize the claim that was made. And so for some time now, I think even the majority of Americans today have asked, did the Iraqis try to kill President George Herbert Walker Bush? Most Americans say, yeah, there was an assassination attempt, and that alone justifies us going to war. Ladies and gentlemen, Newsflash, there was no assassination attempt. It was made up by the Kuwaiti government, working with former elements of the Bush administration, the first Bush administration. The FBI went in to investigate immediately after these allegations were made. They sat down with the plotters. The Kuwaiti government said that the plotters are Iraqi intelligence service professionals who were going to use these explosives to kill your president. Well, the first thing that happened when the FBI got a hold of the plotters is that they recanted their confessions. They said, we were tortured. Now, back in 1993, the United States didn't believe in torture, and any confessions made under duress were thrown out. So the confessions are tossed. Now the FBI goes into a forensic examination of the explosives. And the FBI findings were the explosives were consistent with batch and lot numbers that were brought into Kuwait by the Iraqi military in 1990 and were left behind by the Iraqi military when they withdrew in 1991. Now, from 1991 to 1993, these explosives were under the control of the Kuwaiti government. How could they be under the control of the Iraqi intelligence service? But still, the myth persisted. But the final nails in the coffin occurred when we occupied Iraq in March 2003. We occupied the Iraqi intelligence service. We gained access to the offices responsible for plotting this assassination, only to find that there's no record of such an assassination ever being plotted. We captured every senior Iraqi intelligence service individual that we had said was affiliated with this. They all told Americans, we never tried to kill your president. We know where that came from. It's all made up. All made up. Why is this significant? Because that assassination attempt made sure that Bill Clinton would never carry forward his policy revision vis-a-vis Iraq. Bill Clinton, instead of coming up with a new way of dealing with Saddam Hussein, a way that could have averted war, a way that could have averted economic sanctions that killed over 500,000 Iraqi children, instead was compelled to continue the policy put forward by George Herbert Walker Bush of regime change and of containment through economic sanctions. Now, we say regime change, but here's the ultimate irony. It was not regime change. See, regime change implies getting rid of the Ba'athist Party, getting rid of the brutal dictatorship, getting rid of the Sunni minority dominating Iraq. No, we didn't want regime change. We wanted the same government in place, just led by somebody other than Saddam Hussein. We didn't want regime change. We wanted name change. We wanted a Sunni general who looked like Saddam, talked like Saddam, acted like Saddam, to apply the 75-cent solution, putting a 9-millimeter bullet in the back of Saddam Hussein's head, to take over and then govern Iraq in the exact same fashion. Iraq did not pose a national security threat to the United States of America. Indeed, a Sunni-dominated secular Iraq was to the benefit of the United States because it still served as a bulwark against the expansion of Islamic fundamentalism. We just wanted Saddam gone. And Clinton continued that policy. But he didn't believe in that policy. He didn't act on it until 1994. Then what happened? The Republican Party, Newt Gingrich, captures the Congress. And now the Republicans start to use Bill Clinton's inability or unwillingness to deal effectively with Saddam Hussein for their own political benefit at home. Bill Clinton in 1995 is in a panic because he has an election campaign coming up in 1996. He turns to the CIA and he says, I want that man gone, that man being Saddam Hussein, gone by the early summer 1996. Do it. That's the marching orders given to the CIA. In June 1996, they launched a coup d'etat against Saddam Hussein. It's one that took months to prepare, and it required the CIA not only to recruit people inside Iraq's security services, but to use UN weapons inspections as a vehicle to collect this intelligence and to facilitate the triggering of the coup d'etat. You see, weapons inspections are only useful insofar as they facilitate regime change. It's not about disarmament. Well, the coup failed. It was an absolute failure. The Iraqi government had infiltrated the coup plotters and arrested everybody, and it collapsed. But one thing that the Iraqi government did discover is that there was this link between the CIA's coup d'etat and the United Nations weapons inspectors. And from that moment on, anytime the Iraqi government saw a UN weapons inspector, they didn't see somebody trying to disarm Iraq. They saw somebody trying to kill the president, and they were right. People today say, why didn't Saddam cooperate with the inspectors? Why didn't he just tell the truth? Well, I'm here to tell you that he did tell the truth. When he finally came clean, he said, we destroyed all of our weapons. There's none left. His son-in-law, Hussein Kamal, defects in August 1995. He comes out and says the same thing. All the weapons are gone. I destroyed them all. There's nothing left. But that's not the message the United States wanted to hear. The United States wanted Saddam Hussein gone. And they were using UN weapons inspections to go after his security. You see, the Iraqi government gave full cooperation to the UN weapons inspectors every time they went to a factory, every time they went to a facility that dealt with the technical aspects of disarmament. Only when we went to presidential palaces or intelligence service headquarters or presidential security facilities did the Iraqi government balk and obstruct. Not because they were hiding weapons of mass destruction. Ladies and gentlemen, the CIA today acknowledges that all weapons of mass destruction were destroyed by Iraq in the summer of 1991. The CIA admits that Saddam was telling the truth. So what was Iraq hiding when they blocked the weapons inspectors in 1996, 1997, 1998? They weren't hiding weapons of mass destruction. They were protecting the president from a CIA that was aggressively trying to assassinate him using UN weapons inspectors. You think George W. Bush is going to tell you that truth? Do you think Bill Clinton is going to tell you that truth? No. No one's telling the truth about Iraq. We went to war with Iraq because domestic American politics made it easy for us to go to war in Iraq. You see, during the decade of Bill Clinton, the American people were pre-programmed to believe at face value anything negative about Saddam Hussein and his regime. We didn't want to hear the facts. We just wanted to hear the fiction. You can say anything you want about Saddam. Bad guy. It's easy to say bad things about him. But say anything you want. We're never going to question it. Just say it, we'll believe it. In 1998, again under pressure from the Republicans, Bill Clinton signed into law what's called the Iraq Liberation Act. It's public law voted on by both Republicans and Democrats in Congress and the Senate. It's certified as U.S. policy regime change. It set aside $98 million of U.S. taxpayers' money to fund Iraqi opposition groups to overthrow Saddam Hussein. Now, a lot of people will say, see, Bill Clinton's the one that started this, voted for regime change, and all George W. Bush did is complete the mission. Yes and no. The Iraq Liberation Act forbids the use of U.S. military forces to achieve the removal of Saddam Hussein. It took George W. Bush to change that. But again, it was a change that was easy because we were pre-programmed to accept getting rid of Saddam Hussein. When the Bush administration came into power, they brought with them an ideology of global domination, an ideology that was born in 1992 with the collapse of the Soviet Union, an ideology that was sustained in 1997 with the Project for a New American Century putting out a vision statement, an ideology that got certified as U.S. policy in the 2002 National Security Strategy of the United States of America. It's an ideology that says that the United States owns the world, that the United States has divided the world into strategic spheres of national security interest, that the United States can act unilaterally, preemptively, and militarily whenever it wants to, wherever it wants to sustain the national interest. The Middle East is an area of strategic national interest. The United States, under George W. Bush, has a policy of regime change throughout the Middle East to replace what they call failed states or rogue states with new Western-style democracies. Iraq was the initiator for this policy. Why are we in Iraq? Because it was the easiest war to sell to the American people. We had already bought off at face value that Saddam Hussein was a bad guy, that he was Hitler-like, that he had weapons of mass destruction, and we didn't get in the way of this war. So we're in Iraq. Why is this important? Because we're in Iraq under false pretense. We're not in Iraq to bring democracy. We're in Iraq to spread American global empire. End of story. We're not there to better the lives of the Iraqi people. Hell, we're killing them by the bushel full. People say that Iraq is better off with Saddam Hussein. I beg to differ. Iraq today is worse off than there ever was under Saddam Hussein's regime. Worse off in terms of the economy, worse off in terms of the education system, worse off in terms of health care, and from an American perspective, worse off because we have 138,000 American citizens illegally occupying a sovereign state. Now people say, we got to move forward. Move forward to where? Move forward to where? Because, ladies and gentlemen, if you think this is just about Iraq, think again. The reason why I went through this minutia about weapons of mass destruction and the deception that took place, because it's happening again. But this time, it's about Iran. Listen to the rhetoric coming out of the White House. The time for diplomacy is past, says our Secretary of State, a woman who has also said that war is the only guarantor of peace. The President of the United States says it's over with Iran. We don't have any patience with the Iranians anymore. Why don't we have patience? What don't we have patience about? A nuclear weapons program. See, all I have to do is say that. Most Americans go, oh my God, they have nuclear weapons. That's a threat. We can't have that. We didn't learn anything about Iraq. How many hands go up and say, excuse me, Mr. President, what nuclear weapons program? Where is it? What does it consist of? Where's your evidence? Because if they were bold enough to ask this question and demand an answer, they would find out that there is no evidence. In fact, they would see that the overwhelming amount of data that exists regarding the Iranian nuclear program, not nuclear weapons program, but nuclear energy program, sustains the Iranian argument that it's for peaceful energy uses only. The International Atomic Energy Agency, mandated by law to inspect this, to oversee this, has found no evidence that Iraq has a nuclear weapons program. Indeed, they find that Iraq is not operating in violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Iraq's obeying the law, and yet we want to go to war. We want to go to war. Well, I'm here to tell you, it's not about the nuclear weapons program. It's not about a threat posed by Iran, because Iran poses no threat. It's about sustaining the policy objective of transformation of the Middle East in a manner which is consistent with the national security strategy of the United States that has divided the globe into basic spheres of national interest, where we get to dominate. That's what's happening here, ladies and gentlemen. In July of 2002, the British government reported back on discussions held between the head of British intelligence and the Bush administration. And the British said, a policy has already been made to get rid of Saddam Hussein. The case being put forward is a weak one, built on weapons of mass destruction, and there is no intelligence to sustain this. The Bush administration is fixing intelligence around the policy, making it up. That's why Iraq is important, ladies and gentlemen, because as we speak, the Bush administration has a policy on Iran regarding regime change. That is their policy. They are using the threat posed by a non-existent weapons of mass destruction program as justification. They are fixing intelligence around the policy. The same deception is taking place before our eyes, and we, the people of the United States of America, appear to remain blind to this. Most Americans accept the logic that we can't go to war with Iran. We're bogged down in Iraq. We don't have the troops. It would be insane to go into Iran. Well, I agree. It would be insane to go into Iran. But we're going to do it. And the American people have already given their permission. How dare you say that, Mr. Ritter, you'd say. How dare you say the American people have given their permission. In fact, if you refer to poll numbers, the majority of Americans say they don't want to go to war with Iran. Bad idea. But they do want to go to war with Iran. Or at least that's what they told the president. How did they tell the president this? You see, the majority of Americans accept, 76%, accept at face value the notion that Iran has nuclear weapons or intends to have nuclear weapons. So they've already bought in the Bush administration's contention that Iran poses a threat. Now they say, we don't want to go to war immediately on this one. You have to resolve it using diplomacy. Well, the Bush administration is a master of using diplomacy as a guise for military action. Just take a look at what they did with Iraq. The Bush administration's diplomacy consists of having the Iranian case referred from the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, Austria, to the Security Council of the United Nations, where the Bush administration will push for stringent economic sanctions. The majority of Americans say that the best way to deal with the Iranian nuclear problem is through economic sanctions. That means a Chapter 7 resolution. That means under international law, you're saying that the Iranian threat represents a clear and present risk to international peace and security. The American people have already bought into that line of thinking. And the Bush administration is only happy to help push this matter along. Why? Because we know when it gets to the Security Council, the Russians and the Chinese will veto a sanctions resolution. Now what happens? Does America back down? Can you see George W. Bush getting in front of the American people and saying, hey, the Iranians have a nuclear weapon, everybody agrees, we took it to the UN, Russia and France vetoed it, so we're backing down. I'm going home, have a good day. No. This is why the appointment of John Bolton as the ambassador of the United Nations is so critical. A lot of people make fun of it, say, oh, he's horrible, etc. No, he's not just horrible, ladies and gentlemen, he's dangerous. John Bolton was appointed for one reason and one reason only. Because when the Security Council refuses to issue sanctions, John Bolton will issue it or will read a speech that has already been written. And that speech will say that the United States of America will not allow itself to be held hostage by a Security Council unable or unwilling to deal with a serious threat to international peace and security. If the Security Council refuses to take action, then the United States has no choice but to step forward unilaterally and militarily to deal with the threat in Iran that everybody says exists, even though it doesn't exist. And we're going to go to war. That's what's going to happen, ladies and gentlemen. And the American people are going to be suckered into it. They are being suckered into it. And it's going to happen. It is happening as we speak. Read the headlines. The Bush administration is pushing hard to have Iran referred from Vienna to the Security Council. The Russians and the Chinese have said, don't even think about sanctions. It's happening. How do you stop it? Well, you can't, really, because we have an imperial president who holds himself above the rule of law. We have an imperial president who says Congress has already given him all the authority he needs, not only to carry out warrantless wiretappings of American citizens, not only to authorize the Department of Defense to carry out illegal spying activities against American citizens inside the continental United States, but to wage war whenever and wherever he wants. And he has picked Iran, and we're going to war with Iran. Unless, of course, we can reinvigorate Congress to stand up as the second branch of government to serve as an effective check and balance against the imperial presidency. But you're not going to reinvigorate a Congress that is dominated by the Republican Party. The only way to stop a war with Iran, ladies and gentlemen, is to get Democrats as the majority in the Congress in 2006. Now, a lot of people are going to say, well, and I'm one of them. What Democrats? Where's the Democratic Party? Well, it's not really there. It doesn't really function, especially on a national level. They're just Republican light. But see, right now, there is a growing awareness inside Congress that the Constitution itself is under attack. There is an awareness among Republicans. There's an awareness among Democrats. And there's also a growing recognition that this president has no respect for the rule of law, for constitutional checks and balances. You saw that when the president signed the McCain Amendment, which outlawed torture. God bless John McCain for putting that forward. At last, somebody stood up and did the right thing. Except the president, in signing it, put forward his own statement explaining why he's signing it. He said, the president can authorize torture whenever he wants. The president is not held accountable to Congress. The president is not held accountable to the courts. That when it comes to defending America, the president can do anything he wants. And Congress didn't blink. They just said, okay. That's the direction we're heading. Until we get a Congress that's willing to stand up and challenge this president on constitutional grounds, there is nothing to prevent this president from going to war with Iran. So there we are, ladies and gentlemen, a bleak assessment. We talk about where we're going in Iraq, and we get confused. We tend to think that we're trying to build a democracy. We're not building a democracy in Iraq. We think we're building a security force in Iraq that's going to allow American troops to come home. There is no security force in Iraq, at least no Iraqi security force. There's a Kurdish militia that's trained by the United States. There's a Shia militia that's trained by the United States. And there's Sunni militias that are trained by the United States. The Pentagon tries to sell this amalgamum as a unified security force, the American people, but they're not. There's no security force in Iraq that has an allegiance to a singular entity in Baghdad. Their allegiances are to different regional powers, to sheikhs, to theocrats, to tribal leaders. That's the reality. Iraq is devolving, not evolving. The situation's getting worse. Why? Because the Bush administration doesn't care about Iraq. The Bush administration has its sights fixed firmly on Tehran and Iran, and that is the direction they're heading. People say, hey, wait a minute, you've allowed the Shia theocrats to take control in Iraq. The Bush administration doesn't care, you see, because the Shia theocrats are linked with Tehran. How do you solve the Shia problem in Iraq? Resolve the Shia problem in Iran. If you build a democracy in Iraq, it'll translate into a democracy in Iran, it'll translate into a democracy in Iraq. We're heading towards Tehran, ladies and gentlemen, unless we, the people of the United States of America, can find the way to get representatives elected to higher office that respect the Constitution of the United States of America, a Constitution that the American men and women who serve us so proudly in Iraq took an oath to uphold and defend with their lives. The ultimate shame that can be cast upon us, the American people, is how badly we have betrayed those who serve us in the armed forces. You see, they took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution. They're sworn to give their lives to protect us. They're willing to go out there and do what it takes to ensure that we live in peace and freedom. It's incumbent upon us, therefore, to respect this willingness to sacrifice by ensuring that before we send them out to fight in a cause where they are going to be called upon to give up their lives, that it is a cause worthy of that sacrifice. Ladies and gentlemen, Iraq is not worthy of the sacrifice of a single American life. Neither is Iran, but that's the direction we're heading. If you want to support the troops, support them by A, bringing them home now, and B, making sure they don't go to Iran to begin with. Thank you very much. I'll take any questions you may have.
You have been listening to former UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter, who spoke at West Hartford Town Hall January 24, 2006. For further information on the program you just heard, write to the West Hartford Coalition for Peace and Justice at whcpj@yahoo.com.